Welcome. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS with Karen von Hippel on behalf of the team that's really put this together. Mark Irvin, who's working on the technology right now, Vanessa Kulik, who's back here, and also Malaka Samdani, who's in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and should be on the line as well. I'm going to do a brief introduction, and then I am going to turn to each of you for a 5 to 7 minute introduction. First off, good morning, welcome. We have, it looks like, about 30 Pakistan watchers and interested parties here with us this morning. And this is really part of a series that we have put together to try to expand the knowledge here in Washington and get beyond the conventional wisdom, which is all too prevalent, in by bringing in a few new and fresher Pakistani perspectives. So we're very pleased to have you with us this morning. We have also passed out to each of our guests here this morning a brief piece that four of the Pakistani bloggers that we have been in contact with over the past few months and years, so that there will be their perspective as well for our guests to look at. What I'm asking is that each of you will give a brief introduction, 5 to 7 minutes, with your key points. We are able to put up on the screen who you are and a little bit about where you are and your titles.
Hello.
So the order that we are going in is Stefan Darnoff will go first. He is the country director for IFIS and has worked in multiple countries on election issues around the world. He is in Islamabad. We will then go to Sarvar Bari, who is the Secretary General of the Free and Fair Election Network, as well as being the founder of one of the leading NGOs in Pakistan, and a longtime political activist who was forced into exile during the Zia regime. Then we will listen to Ishaf Shafi Gulani, who's been the chairman of Gallup Pakistan since 1980, along with a number of other distinguished positions. And finally, Osama Siddiqui, who is a lawyer activist and an associate professor at Lahore University of Management Sciences, LUMS, in Lahore, will speak more about the some of the legal and political ramifications in the political party situation. So we should have a good overview. I'm hoping that each of the speakers can limit themselves to that 5 to 7 minute introduction so that we can have a dialogue as well. And if you are in place, we can hear you quite well, and I will interrupt if I think you are running on a bit too long or we cannot hear you. Otherwise, you have a pretty free rein, and I will cue up each of you. Stefan, if you are there, we would love to have you start, please.
Thank you very much, and it's good to be with you from Islamabad. Just to start out with, I mean, organizing elections in Pakistan is no easy task. And based on my personal experience from working inside the Election Commission of Pakistan for the last year and a half, I will give you some insight on the strengths and the weaknesses of this institution. First, let's look at the task at hand. The ECP is supposed to organize an election for 81 million voters. In order to do this, it must hire and train 500,000 poll workers and open almost 65,000 polling stations on Monday, all which must receive the necessary polling materials. This is no small challenge in the middle of the winter in a country with a rudimentary infrastructure and mountainous topography. On top of that, in some provinces, the security situation is less than conducive. Having said that, several factors actually speak in favor of the ECP being able to handle these challenges. Firstly, the ECP has organized many elections before, such as general elections, local elections, by-elections, and even referendums. Secondly, the ECP has offices at national level, all the four provinces, and all the 120-plus districts. The ECP also has 1,600 permanent staff fully dedicated to this task. In addition, all the ECP senior managers have worked internationally as election officials for the UN in places like Cambodia, East Timor, Liberia, and Kosovo. But in spite of all these factors, speaking in favor of a solid election commission, I'm of the opinion that the ECP is punching well below its weight. The primary reason for this is the ECP's organizational structure. Its headquarters is basically a blueprint of any federal secretariat and not geared towards its unique task. For instance, it is supposed to train 500,000 poll workers, and the organization does not have a training unit. It is supposed to educate 81 million voters on how to cast a ballot, but it only has one civic education officer in the entire organization. Also, it needs to supply 65,000 polling stations with election material, but the organization does not have a logistics officer. So, if we have some problems on election day, it might not be due to political manipulation, but simply because ECP's organization structure is not optimal. On election day itself, there's one aspect I would like to highlight, and that is how the results are tallied here in Pakistan. After polling is completed, the votes will be counted in the polling station. Party agents and observers will be present and receive a copy of the result sheet. This is all in accordance with international practice. However, the result sheets are transported by the presiding officer to a returning officer who's in charge of the elections in a constituency and also for the aggregation of the results. Usually this individual is looking after around 250 polling stations. Here is where the problem starts. In some locations, observers and party agents will be allowed into the returning officer and observe. In other places, they are not. Secondly, even when observers are allowed in to oversee how the results are being tallied, it is almost never done in a transparent manner. No procedures have been issued by the ECP instructing the returning officer how to do this. So the practice is that he simply sits down with his assistant and tallies the results. In the end, the returning officer only hands over the total number of votes received by each candidate to the observer. No breakdown of the results by polling stations are provided. It is therefore impossible to verify that the correct results from the individual polling stations are actually used by the returning officer or if he has changed them. Also, the ECP centrally does not publish results by polling station, make it impossible to verify the results. The political situation in Pakistan is very volatile, and we're likely to hear loads of complaints of a manipulated result following this election. Unfortunately, due to the lack of transparency in its current result system, it is not possible for the ECP to defend its results even if everything was above board. Thank you. These are my introductory remarks.
Thank you. You've been the model first speaker. Thank you for bringing so much information so succinctly. And if Sarvar, if you are there, Sarvar Bari will go next, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm Sarvar Bari from Pakistan. I'm heading a network called Free and Fair Election Network, which has 40-plus NGOs, and we have been working since 2006 when this network was established, and we have been covering electoral processes for the last 1 year. And we now have long-term observers, and we are going to deploy about 20,000 short-term observers, which will be covering about 8,000 polling stations, and both male and female polling stations. And each constituency, we will be covering about 30 polling stations. We have now 264 constituency coordinators out of 272, and we are covering almost 90% of the districts of Pakistan. These constituency coordinators and district coordinators have been sending information on through checklist, which is being provided to everybody over there. And on the basis of that, I can say about pre-poll phase of this election. Our findings are I can say that this election, as far as the pre-poll phase is concerned, is one of the most contested elections of Pakistan history. This is also the most conflicted elections of Pakistan history. And then I could also say that this is the most controversial elections and the most constrained elections. Now, I can give you the reasons why I'm saying this. This is based on our 15 updates so far we have published and has disseminated through a website and to the media. And I can say that now, as far as the most contested election is concerned, because the way events have progressed before the election schedule was announced. It started with the sacking of Chief Justice of Pakistan in March 2007, and that triggered a lot of events in Pakistan, the civil society, the bar councils, the media came out and started protesting against the sacking of Chief Justice. And then closing to the election schedule, the way presidential elections were held, and then the way 66 senior judges of the Supreme Court and high courts were sacked. They were independent-minded judges. And then like-minded judges were appointed in Pakistan, and that has made these elections very controversial. And as a result of that, about 21 political parties are boycotting the election, including three very major political parties of Pakistan. Also, there is now the three political parties are being split, one who are boycotting, and three major political parties of Pakistan, the Pakistan People's Party, Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz Sharif Group, and Awami National Party, are participating under protest. So this is, and then there are parties who have not said anything wrong about the political electoral process, which are PMLQ, which is the former ruling party, and MQM, which is based in Karachi. Another issue which is very important I would like to flag here is the issue of electoral roll. When electoral roll were displayed for public scrutiny, we found out that 37 million voters were missing from that. So that also created a huge controversy in Pakistan. And as a result of that, about 20 million people were brought from to the electoral roll from 2002. And that has created also problems. Through the imposition of emergency on November 3rd, media freedom was also curbed. What had happened afterwards, Nawaz Sharif, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, he tried to come back to Pakistan. He was thrown back. There was an attempt on Benazir Bhutto on 18th of October, in her possession, where 140 people were killed. And then the way Musharraf held his own elections and the way the caretaker setup was established. So all these events, now moving towards elections, has created enormous concerns and apprehensions in Pakistan. The way the most caretaker ministers and chief ministers and four of the governors of Pakistan have their open loyalties with the former ruling parties. Some of the caretaker ministers and chief ministers have their close relatives contesting elections. Most of the district nazams, district mayors and tahsil mayors have their immediate family members contesting elections. And there are enough evidence which shows that these caretaker ministers and chief ministers and the district mayors have been seen using official machinery and resources for the election campaign of their relatives and party candidates. So this has created a lot of problems for the opposition candidates. And as a result of that, it is being reported by our constituency coordinators that the election is not, as far as the level playing field is concerned, it is not available to all contesting parties. So this has made, as far as the pre-poll phase of this election is concerned, very, very controversial. And I'm not saying that on the basis of this, we can say the polling will be rigged or will be influenced. But I think this is very important to understand this. But the good aspect is of this election is that we have unprecedented number of women candidates. And most of these women, about 40% of these women, are contesting as an independent candidates. But also the political parties have nominated more women. So this is perhaps the most interesting and important aspect of these elections. We are fully prepared to monitor elections on the election day. We will be deploying 20,000 static observers in 8,000 male and female polling stations, and we will be releasing information, aggregating the information and disseminating it to the public and to the media. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well for that really excellent overview. I think for a different perspective, Ijaz Shafi Gulani will go next. Mr. Gulani, Dr. Gulani.
Good. Thank you very much. It's evening here, but I guess I should say good morning to all of you. While my colleagues gave the process of elections in Pakistan, I will briefly give the history of elections in Pakistan. I suppose Mark has a slide for you. As you would look in that slide, there have been 8 elections in Pakistan since 1970. The current election, therefore, would be the 9th one in the series. What might be important to grasp Pakistani elections, that even though we have had long spells of military governments, yet when elections are held in Pakistan, they are competitive elections. These should not be compared with elections in the former Soviet countries or the East European countries or even the Middle Eastern countries, where elections were more of a form rather than substance. In the case of Pakistan, whenever elections are held, generally, they are highly mobilized and competitive. The political parties in Pakistan also, they may not be institutionalized very well, but they are grassroots parties. They have organizational structure that springs up during election time in particular, and also stays even otherwise, even if for purposes of local reasons. If you look at the elections, the 1970 election was the one in which Mr. Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto became the leader. He remained until 1977 when he held another election. There were massive accusations of rigging in that election, and it was annulled. The assembly never met. Subsequently, a party-less election in 1985, held by General Ziaul Haq. 1988 is about the time when General Haq met his air crash, and elections were then held a month or so later. And then we've had a series of elections until 1997. That was the election when General Musharraf, he overthrew that government and in 1999 took over. The 2002 election was held by General Musharraf. What I'd like to place before you, that in these elections, there are some patterns to voting in Pakistan. And there are 4 clusters of that show throughout this period. The first cluster, what we call as the Pakistan People's Party vote cluster. The third is the religious parties vote cluster. And the fourth one is the regional parties for voting cluster. These voting clusters have remained throughout all of the Pakistan's 8 elections. The second element in Pakistani elections are the 4 provinces. And I will move on to the next slide that shows Punjab province. This is the largest in terms of population, 55% roughly, and therefore in the parliament also has 55% share. I will come back to the politics of the provinces, but first their sizes. The second is the Sindh province. This has 25%, one quarter. It has both an urban area dominated by Karachi and then the rural area. The third is the Northwest Frontier province, approximately 15% share in the parliament. And the last one, Balochistan, very large in area, but only 5% of the population and hence of seats. I should go back to Punjab. The politics in Punjab has largely been the Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League. These two have dominated in all the 8 elections between the two of them. I call it as the bipolar contest in Punjab, and it has great implications for the results of any election. The second is the Sindh province. In Sindh, there is a clear distinction between urban Sindh, which is dominated by a regional party, mostly limited to Karachi in terms of its electoral success, and that is the MQM. In all elections since 1988, it has had big margins over the runner-up, generally almost twice the runner-up vote. In the interior of Sindh, it is the Pakistan People's Party which dominates. The frontier province, which comes next, has all the 4 clusters of Pakistani politics represented in it. And I think in questions and answers, many people would have interest in religious parties and their success in the last elections and how it came about, and I should explain that. The last is the Balochistan province. Let me now move to the 2008 elections. When these elections were announced by General Pervez Musharraf, they would be held in 2008. The process started in 2007. Many people thought that the purpose of the election was to consolidate the political power structure present at that time, which the president played a key role. In fact, somewhat of an extra constitutional role, because the constitution provides the prime minister to be the chief executive. This was not possible unless General Pervez Musharraf extended his support base. His current support base was only one faction of the Muslim League and the MQM, the PMLQ and MQM. So to extend, he needed the Pakistan People's Party as one prospect of bringing to his fold. These were some of the events which started rolling in 2007, as if politics could be guided from above through elections. But as it appeared, elections have its own dynamics, and elections also follow changes in society. The events that rolled in 2007 showed that the society had moved much ahead of what people on the top had thought of. So when General Musharraf tried to subdue the Supreme Court, it seemed the entire country turned up, asked for rule of law, and General Musharraf had to back down. Unfortunately, this was not backing down for good. The process which had been initiated with the purpose of continuing himself in power did not stop there. In my view, that is the great crisis of this election. The society has moved forward. It demands greater democratization, it demands greater rule of law, and hence the current rulers are finding it difficult to adjust this mismatch between what has happened to society and how much of democracy people on the top are willing to give. I'm therefore not surprised when sometimes President Musharraf says Pakistan is not ready for real democracy. It needs a local version. If we go by the popular view showed up in the public opinion surveys, President Musharraf is perhaps not correct. In our view, shown in the surveys, the country, the population in general, is ready for a much more real taste of democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you as well. That was terrific. Our final speaker is Osama Siddiqui. And Osama, if you are there, we will go to you next.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, thanks a lot for giving me this opportunity. I guess my task in many ways is the least enviable one because my more senior colleagues have covered a lot of ground in terms of the capacity constraints of the Election Commission and the process, also the fair, you know, various kinds of pre-poll anxieties which all of us are facing. And then, of course, Mr. Gilani gave a very useful historical review. I would perhaps just like to re-emphasize here, because this discussion can get into various different aspects, that the stakes are extremely high as far as these elections are concerned, and as far as not just Pakistan, but, you know, other communities of nations are also concerned. And I say that because, as was already mentioned, there was, I think, a fairly concerted attempt on part of the Musharraf regime to somehow try and delay these elections. Time and again, he has come up with statements, and indeed the outgoing Prime Minister, Mr. Shaukat Aziz, seemed fairly keen on the idea that the elections should be postponed indefinitely. So in that sense, the stakes are very high because in many ways the outcome of these elections are going to decide several important things. They'll decide whether the Musharraf regime and the Musharraf era is going to come to a close. They're going to decide the role of the army in Pakistan's politics, because one sees some fairly significant moves for change in that direction. It will also decide how federal politics is going to take place in this country, because federal instability is a big issue now, and what is going to be the approach of the new government. Very significantly, it is going to decide, and something which is fairly close to my heart as a lawyer, the state of the judiciary. In many ways, whether we are going to stick to this judiciary or to revive the original judiciary is going to have a huge medium to long-term bearing on the quality of justice in this country. Also, the shape of the constitution, which has been changed once again, the nature and progress or regress of the so-called war on terror, are all issues which are deeply tied to this election. The problem, in addition to what these worthy gentlemen have been saying, is that these elections have also caused a huge schism between those forces who want change. And hence you see this huge divide within the legal community as well as the political parties. And in many ways, my perception after having spoken to a lot of bar leaders is that elections are inevitable. They are comparatively diplomatic about saying something about whether they should take place or not, but they feel that the aftermath of the election is perhaps going to open up space and give them more opportunities to agitate their two main issues, which is the restoration of the judiciary and the constitution. But and at the same time, as has been mentioned by, I believe, Mr. Bari, that quite a few of the main political parties, who though they do not have that many electoral seats, they do have the street power to make a difference, are also not contesting in this election. So there's this schism, and let's see whether this gap is filled after the election. But tied to this entire thing, because of the events since last year in March when the Chief Justice was unconstitutionally removed, are several perceptions of lack of credibility. And I think to the extent that actual mishaps do take place, to the extent that actual rigging does take place, it's also the perception of how fair these elections are going to be, which are going to matter a lot. There have been reports of pre-election rigging. People I've spoken to in the government also talk about junior government officers whose identity cards have perhaps been procured by one of the ruling parties in order to use them on the election day. So it's not as if you can safeguard against rigging on the day of the election itself. There are lots of these events which have taken place. There's the entire security situation. And because of all those bomb blasts, that may have a bearing in terms of people actually stepping out to vote. And that can have a difference. The Nazim system, post-Musharraf's revolution, of course, creates a cadre of people at the district level who are very much close to the ruling party. The state machinery misuse, which Mr. Bari was mentioning, is also a fact, and it's fairly visible. If you visit Lahore these days, you can still see that the bulk of the Lahore police is actually parked outside the official, or rather the private residence of the ex-chief minister. There's the possibility of the harassment on the day issue. I was in Sindh last week and met with various politicians, including PPP politicians and Mr. Zardari, and they fear that perhaps, considering that Sindh is going to be very pro-PPP after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, the only way to bungle things up may be to actually commit violence on the day. The media is still playing a role, but its gagging in the recent past has made a difference in terms of their free reporting. If there are going to be any legal issues with rigging and things like that, there's very little faith in the courts anymore, considering the judges we have now, in terms of any post-rigging judicial redress. And then, of course, the caretaker government itself has come under a lot of criticism. So all these factors combined and the events leading up to the elections actually make a lot of people suspicious. But we're pretty much, to use a cliche, facing a choice of the devil in the deep blue sea. If we don't have elections, Mr. Musharraf is very happily going to carry on. If we do have elections and they're heavily rigged or masterminded, he may have another excuse to carry on. But perhaps a lot of people feel that the elections are going to change the power structure somewhat, and also this monopoly of over the coercive power of the state. And that may open up more ground for agitation and to actually at least restore the judiciary and the constitution. Thank you.
Thank you all for your very succinct and thoughtful remarks. What I'm going to do is, because there are now about 40 people in the room, if the people in the room here could just give me an indication that you have a question, and I'll sort of keep track. And I think what we might do, because of the unpredictability of the of the technology, is to ask several questions, and then each of you can pick off which ones you would like to speak to. I think that will work best. But so if people could start to give me a sense, if you're behind me, just let me know if somebody behind me has a question, if you would. So why don't you step over here, just if you could sit over by the microphone. You're going to have to get to a microphone if you have a question. While people are getting set up for this first question, please identify yourself as well. I'd like to start off by just a number of you, in a way, have mentioned the perception of the elections. There are some people who think that there are many people who think that the elections will essentially be a defeat for President Musharraf, but it doesn't really matter because he's restructured the government so that he has the authority anyway, so that the end result is a stalemate. That's a different kind of a perception problem, that you can have an election, it might work, but the results really don't matter anyway. And that would be the first question that I'd ask, and let's move to the second questioner.
My name is Dana Marshall, and the question is whether there are any credible polls or ones that people are sort of suggesting might be the most accurate indication of what pollsters think the result will be in the election, so that that might serve as some sort of an indication of whether the results Monday match up to any extent with what the previous polls had come up with. There was an interesting poll published in the Washington Post on a few days ago from the International Republican Institute that a lot of people have looked at, and in some people's minds indicate what the election might look like were it sort of done in a way that the pollsters did their polling. I wonder that the question is whether there's any sort of a view in Pakistan now about sort of like a poll of polls or some indication of what people might expect based on polling the results to be.
This is Rick Barton again. Maybe you could step up to a microphone if you would. Just pull your chair right up. There's plenty of room there to bring your chair up.
I'll just end. Josephine Fransen from the Netherlands Embassy. I was wondering whether you could say something about what sort of situation the elections will lead to and what sort of government you think can be in place? You were talking about a change of power structure. Is it going to be a power structure that will allow Pakistan to be stable? Thank you.
Great. Let me just throw a couple other quick questions into this mix here. Do you feel, Sarwar, you're going to have people at all over the country? Do you feel as if your own election, your what you call static observers, do you feel they will be safe? And where do you worry about the safety issue most? For Stefan, you mentioned that the initial counts are conducted at the local level, but then they're not publicized till they get up to the district level. Will there be any way to see any of those local counts that to see what whether the aggregated voting is actually reflective of any of the localities? And then I'd like to ask Dr. Gilani if you mentioned Musharraf's misreadings. And how do you think he might misread the results of this election, since that seems to have been his pattern? So I hope that provides you all something to nibble on. If you could just, who would like to go first?
Can I start?
Yes, please. Remind us of, we haven't memorized your voice yet, so please remind us who you are.
Yeah, I'm Sarwar Bhadi.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. You asked me about the safety of our static observers and the security situation. In some areas, today there was one incident in one of the tribal areas that our training session was attacked by extremist militants, and they beaten up some of our staff. And they took away all the training material, and they threatened our observers. So in some areas, of course, situation will not be very conducive for election observation, but that I hope will not be widespread. But of course, there are the main concern is that most of the districts of frontier province have already been declared troubled districts, and the situation in Balochistan is such that most political parties of Balochistan, who have a lot of influence in Balochistan, almost all Baloch nationalist parties and Pakhtun nationalist parties are boycotting. And they are not just boycotting, but they are also now, it appears to us that they are also gearing up to intimidate voters, and maybe to some groups or parties who intend to vote. So, but despite this, we have managed to hire and to deploy most of our observers in more than 250 constituencies. But of course, if we would find any problem and early warnings of violence, then we will withdraw. But I think we are perhaps less worried about extremist situation from extremists, but we are also worried because in some districts where we are expecting that the local candidates may use state machinery and the election authorities in their favor, they may not allow our observers to observe the whole polling process and the counting process. So it's not only on the extremists, but also from some of the local influentials, because these tribal chiefs and big feudal lords, they have a lot of influence over state machinery and through their own goons. But I must mention here that as far as election-related violence is concerned, we have never been witnessed like widespread violence in Pakistan in comparison to Bangladesh and India. So I hope that the extremists are using some violence, because curfew has already been declared, imposed in Swat. But this is, in my view, is not election-related violence. This kind of violence has been going on since 2001, but of course it has increased in 2007. That's in fact the militants, extremists are using election campaign in order to achieve their own objectives. So that's the worrying side. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Please, who would like to go next? Take any of the questions.
Okay, then. Sure. The question about the count. Well, we will know at the polling station level what the result is. The problem is, as I mentioned before, at the returning officer level. We might be fortunate at some of these locations that the returning officer, on his own initiative, will have somewhat of a transparent process. But if not, we will actually not know if he tallied the actual results from the individual polling station correctly when he made up the aggregate results for the candidates. There's been a lot of pressure put on the Election Commission of Pakistan to change this procedure from the international community. We're running a bit out of time to actually make some changes because the election is on Monday. So my sense is the best we can wish for right now is that we will have polling station-based results a couple of weeks after Election Day issued by the ECP centrally. I will just touch upon a few of the other questions that were raised here about what kind of governance. Well, first of all, we might take into consideration that we might not have a clear-cut result come Wednesday, because here in Pakistan, you have a bit of a strange electoral system, because a candidate is allowed to run in more than one constituency, even in the same election. And a lot of the leading politicians representing various parties are running in more than one constituency and are also likely to win in more than one constituency. So they will accept one of these seats, and the other constituency, there will be a by-election, which will take time to do. So if we really have a tight race here, we might not know who will form the government until sometime in mid-March and not on Wednesday. That's important to keep in mind. So there might be a fairly long impasse when Pakistan will be run by this interim government. I believe that Dr. Gilani will talk about the IRI poll and its credibility, given that he's a professional pollster himself. The question about the presidential system and the perception of the election, I just want to note one thing here, that yes, Pakistan used to have a parliamentary system, but based on all these changes that have been taking place when it comes to the constitution, we basically have a presidential system. So it's correct to say that these parliamentary elections are not as important as they used to be here in Pakistan. Thank you very much.
This is Osama Siddiq. I have a slight point of departure from the last speaker, but I guess that perhaps it would be better if Mr. Gilani spoke first about the poll projections, and then I could take up that point.
All right. I think the question which Mr. Marshall raised was, can polls be used to monitor the fairness of the elections? So can there be a departure between the results announced by the government and the ones determined by the polls? That in our system, since it is a parliamentary system with 272 constituencies, it is rather difficult, almost impossible, to carry out polls at the constituency level. Hence, that is not possible. But the underlying assumption, again, in the question and also in some of the other discussion is that there is large-scale rigging on the election day, that ballot boxes can possibly be stuffed or that duplicate votes may be polled or that there might be counting fraud. My view might be a minority view on this, but in my assessment of the last 8 elections, that is not the case. The rigging done on the election day, except for one of our 8 elections, has not been large enough to affect the outcome. The unlawful interference in the election process, if should we call that as rigging, generally happens in setting up the playing field and in certain other kinds of influences unlawful by the government before the elections and also after the elections. Those are the ones that really bring in the unlawful influence of the government. I might want to show you a slide in my presentation, if Mark was to show that, and that is the slide on the decisive contest in Punjab with People's Party votes.
Yeah, sure, we can bring that
Mark,
up.
Mark, would you be able to do that?
He's moving.
It's actually on the screen now.
Fine. So if you see that, the electoral performance of the Pakistan People's Party begin in 1970 and going on. As you see, it's a very straight curve. If there was massive interference on the polling day, it is rather unlikely that a political party, which sometimes received the support of government and other times was on the receiving end, would not have had this stable line. The crux of my argument is that when we try to look for on the rigging and unfairness issue, looking at the election day may be the wrong place. On the election day, I expect that whatever the people cast their votes, the final outcome is roughly the same. That would be my answer. I'll be happy to pursue it further should the questioner ask on this. I would also like to take up the parliamentary and presidential system.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? And just looking at your chart, it appears as if the PPP had a high of about 40% of the vote and a low of 22%. So that would be, you would expect that they would be in that range, and if they were substantially below that number or near the lower end because they're expected to have something of a sympathy vote, that would be an indication of some questions in the tally. Is that fair?
That's right. If it was, let's say, suppose it was to go below 22% or even there would be questions should be raised.
So they should be...
That's unlikely to happen in my assessment.
Okay.
But should it go below 20%, I think serious questions should be raised.
Thank you. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
Fine. Just a quick remark on the parliamentary and presidential system that one of our colleagues there raised at the end. Sure, there have been changes in the Constitution, but these are not significant enough to really legally change it from a parliamentary system in which the Prime Minister is the chief executive to another system where the President becomes the chief executive. In fact, part of the exercise, authority exercised by President Pervez Musharraf is according to the Constitution, but much of the power that he exercises is in fact constitutional, one might say unlawful. The manner in which he runs Pakistan's foreign policy or the manner in which he runs the Pakistan economy or the interior affairs is not the authority granted to him, even by the Constitution in its present shape. The real thing is just sometimes leaders become unlawful. Thank you. That's the end of my remark.
Can I comment on electoral rolls? Because, hello?
Please go ahead.
Yeah. Because
Bari might be the best. Comment on that.
Well, I would like to talk about the electoral roll, which are now being will be used on election day. We have analyzed the electoral roll, and we have found out that there are nearly 4.2 million duplicate voters, fake voters, who managed to get their names registered more than once in some areas, even some, we found some voters registered more than six times in same constituency. Now that can change results in some constituency because we have first past the post system, and on average, we have about now 14,000 voters who are duplicate or more than that. So I think that's very important, and unlike many other countries, I think it's very important that on election day, a person who comes to vote, it's not that we should just mark his finger with this indelible ink, just a small sign which we used to do in the past. I think it's important to dip his or her finger in the ink bottle. And also we urge Election Commission of Pakistan to delete these duplicate voters, which can be done quickly. But also I would like to mention that more than 310 candidates are contesting on more than two or more seats, and about 55 candidates are contesting on three or more seats. So I would like to agree with Mr. Stephan that can delay the formation of government as well, because Election Commission has already announced that the by-elections would happen in April. So this is unprecedented number of candidates who are contesting on more than one seats in Pakistan's history. And it's very important that we should keep an eye that how this is going to affect. But also there is a need to investigate, and that cannot be done now, but after the election, that who are these voters whose names are registered in the same constituency or in two constituencies in the same city more than once. And that can be that can also help to certify election results in after the election as well.
Could I ask one technical question? What was the thinking or the logic of the argument for candidates being able to run in more than one constituency? Where did that tradition develop?
Well, this tradition has been in Pakistan since 1970, when Bhutto, Mr. Bhutto, contested from four constituencies. And the election laws allow candidates to contest on more than one seat. And as a result of that, some of women contestants are found that they are contesting on general seats as well, but their names are also on the reserve seats quota as well. So we civil society organizations have been demanding that this law should be changed. A candidate should not be allowed to contest on more than one seat. So this is a demand, because this is bringing a monopoly of a few families. But here I would like to mention here as well, because a large number of candidates belong to a same political dynasty. So it's not that they are contesting from generation to generation. But with the increase of parliamentarian seats, now one can find out that how many members of a family contesting elections and have female members on the quota seats. So this has increased, in fact, the monopoly of these few families in Pakistani legislative assemblies, which is a serious, which has a serious bearing on governance of Pakistan as well.
Thank you very much.
Just to add here, Bari Sahib, perhaps the background to this permission to contest for more than one seat was to reflect the national character of major party leaders. So there are four provinces, and in some cases, it was meant to provide the opportunity for major party leaders to present themselves for elections not only from their home province, but also from other provinces. I might also add that while there are 300 people contesting for multiple seats, the ones who might actually win more than one seat would be far fewer. So I would not really see that as a major detriment. The real detriments are others, and we might as well look at where the real problems are.
Maybe I should address the issue of the voters list, since IFES has been working with ECP on this very issue, and I would like to just clarify a few things. We need to realize that the voters list that we used in the 2002 election was of such poor quality that the ECP had to start all over, as it contained more than 6 million duplicates and more than 20 million names that couldn't be verified as legitimate voters. So in 2006, the ECP went house to house and collected registration data. This generated a 52 million strong draft electoral roll. The positive thing with this new electoral roll was it was highly accurate. In fact, it was probably the most accurate voters list in the history of Pakistan. However, as my friend Mr. Bari noted, it had some drawbacks because it was not complete enough. The 2002 list held 72 million names. And as I mentioned, the new one held only 52 million. So we had a drop of some 20 million names from these 5 years. The PPP took ECP to the Supreme Court, arguing that the names that were on the 2002 list but missing from the new list should be transferred wholesale onto the new list. This sounds reasonable, but you're actually running a huge risk of moving large number of these duplicate, deceased, and unverified voters from the old list onto the new list, and thereby diluting the quality of the voters list. I personally warned the PPC of this huge risk, but they still decided to move ahead with this solution at the Supreme Court. So the voters list to be used on election day will not be as complete nor as accurate as we would have liked it to be due to the Supreme Court's decision. So that's the background why we have problems. And a vast number of these duplications that we see on the voters list right now hails from the 2002 list. In fact, when we checked from our end, we said on the database, we noticed that one person had registered 112 times on the roll. And I totally agree with Mr. Bari that it's of critical importance that the election commission start prosecuting people that blatantly violated the law and registered more than one in one constituency, because that's an extremely good deterrent. Up until today, never have this taken place in Pakistan. Thank you.
I think Professor Siddiqui...
The other questions which has not been addressed, I feel this is Osama Siddiq, which is an observation by, I believe, a lady in the audience who said that perhaps it does not matter to Mr. Musharraf as to what happens in these elections because he's sufficiently entrenched due to the changes he's already made in the governance structure and the constitution. I would tend to disagree because I feel that there are several kinds of things which can take place after these elections which may be a threat to him. The first example I may have is a possible impeachment of the president under Article 47 of the Constitution. Now, one thing needs to be taken care of, that you need a two-third majority in both houses of parliament, and the Senate is already entrenched with people who were actually appointed according to a different appointment election cycle, and they may be closer to the current regime. But then who knows whether the mood on the street and the mood of politics in the National Assembly is also going to influence them, and the numbers in the National Assembly would actually matter in terms of such a move. The other possible constitutional challenge can be a constitutional amendment under Article 238 to undo the changes made by President Musharraf post 3rd of November, with a similar issue of whether the people can actually unite themselves for such an event and whether they have the requisite numbers. The other important factor to look at, which may influence things after elections, is that if there's too much mayhem and civil disobedience, in the sense that a lot of the people from PMLN and PPP do not get elected, and they join the street protest, which was a missing link in the earlier sort of civil society movement, that has its own impetus for change. And then, of course, the continuing role of the army needs to be observed because, as I mentioned earlier, Musharraf is no longer the chief of the army staff, and to that extent, his constituency and power through the army is getting diluted, and that has an effect. Now, the other comment made by one of the speakers, I believe it was Mr. Darnold, was about the fact that perhaps we now have a presidential system. And I would also disagree with that, because barring Article 58.2b, which was introduced in very dubious circumstances during General Ziaul Haq's regime, and which gives extraordinary powers to the president on a fairly subjective evaluation to dissolve the National Assembly, and indeed which was exercised four times between 1988 and the end of 90s, is the power which really gives him a grip on the parliament, because he can just go ahead and dissolve an assembly, and much of the jurisprudence on Article 58.2b, an area on which I've done extensive work, shows that there are various limits on his power. We still have a lame duck judiciary, which is the current judiciary. So that is a power which, if through an amendment of the Constitution, is removed, Mr. Musharraf doesn't really have any constitutional powers to do much about the assemblies. And in many ways, I agree with Mr. Gilani that his exercise of power has nothing to do with legal or constitutional powers which he has. So barring Article 58.2b, this is very much a prime ministerial, a parliamentary form kind of a government. And that one particular amendment is highly controversial, but I don't think that makes the Pakistani system a presidential system of government.
If I might pick up the last point, one of the confusion in the public mind, which is also withholding participation, is what are the elections meant to do? If they are meant to produce a chief executive by holding parliamentary elections, electing a parliament, which then provides a leader in the shape of a prime minister who becomes the chief executive to run foreign policy, domestic affairs, so on and so forth, then what would be the role of President Musharraf? If President Musharraf is to continue with his present exercise of power, then the entire exercise of elections is futile. Should it produce another prime minister like the ones we have had during the last 5 years, then there is not much point holding these elections. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's do one. I'm not sure if there's any other questions here. It looks like there is one more round of questions, if we could do that. How are you all doing on your end? Is the telephone getting tiring?
No, we're fine.
Okay, we've certainly enjoyed
it. No, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right, we're really enjoying your comments a great deal. Maybe why don't let's go to three more questions, and that will be it. Please identify yourself, and then just step up to the microphone, if you would. If you're in the back row, just find a microphone as well.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Gritz, and my question was, Professor Siddiqui mentioned that there are, you know, a number of issues that can
could
be...
Could you please start again? I just lost your voice.
Yes. Professor Siddiqui mentioned that there are a number of issues that the parliament could change if a certain party was elected. And I was just wondering, how quickly could changes to... the political situation in Pakistan occur? Like, if a parliament was elected, that could infringe upon President Musharraf's power?
Well, I think that the key to doing anything in terms of curtailing Mr. Musharraf's power is to take away Article 58.2b, which was done actually once before during Mr. Nawaz Sharif's second government, when there was a very quick alliance between the PPP and the PMLN to actually introduce an amendment to the Constitution which got rid of Article 58.2b. It is a bit more difficult to predict this time, because much as Mr. Nawaz Sharif has been using the bringing back of the judiciary and the restoration of the Constitution as a political message and slogan very effectively and very vociferously, the People's Party's stance on this is less than clear. Some of the other parties, of course, who are very pro this move, which Mr. Sharif is promising, are not contesting the elections. The right-wing MMA and the MQM are also silent on it and have traditionally been partners with Mr. Musharraf. So I think it depends a lot on whether the PMLN wins enough seats, they abide by their promise, and whether they can bring the People's Party around to this particular commitment. It also seems to me that it's a bit of a circular situation. It's not so much their promises which they make right now. It will also be a function of how strengthened do they feel in terms of the actual seats they win and go to the parliament with? And that will also have a bearing on whether PMLN or CPP actually emerges as a dominant party and is then enticed to go into partnership with Mr. Musharraf. And if they are dependent on each other and Mr. Musharraf remains a common foe, and there's enough pressure from the streets and the lawyers and the civil society for them to bring back the judges, then one logical thing would be to get rid of Article 58-2B. But for that, you need the numbers and the commitment.
Thank you. My name is Mattis Rausel. I'm from the Embassy of Norway. I have a question about the role of the military. I believe it was Professor Siddiq who mentioned that there's been some signals that the military might back away from political life. On what basis do you, if I understood you correctly, do you make that suggestion? And is that type of scenario dependent on a specific outcome of the elections, which are coming on Monday?
I'm sorry, who is this question addressed to?
I brought it up. I think it was Professor Siddiq who mentioned the role of the military. But if anyone else wants to have a go, you're more than welcome.
Okay, I mean, I think the role of the military is important, obviously, for historical reasons. The very fact that the...
I think we have some problems with the phone line right now.
Okay. I mean, I guess for fairly well-understood historical reasons, the role of the army has to be observed. But I think one phenomenon, and my more senior colleagues can perhaps add to that, is the very open criticism of the role of the army, which has permeated our public discussions over the last year and a half. The other factor, of course, is the very direct attacks, which are now taking place on military cantonments, on military personalities. Of course, this entire embroilment in earlier in Balochistan and now in Fatah and other areas of the north. To many observers, it seems that has causing a major reconsideration within the army of the role which they have to play. I'm not at all being overtly optimistic here and suggesting that the army's role is going to transform overnight, but some visible moves have been made. For example, the current chief of the army staff made an announcement and then followed up on the idea of withdrawing a lot of army officers who were posted in key civilian positions. So there's obviously an attempt on part of the new army leadership for a less visible civilian involvement on part of the army. So in many ways, movement continues, one can logically hope that they may also want to distance themselves from Mr. Musharraf, especially if Mr. Musharraf continues in the same vein post-elections as he has been continuing over the last 1 year. And he can't really control the army as the chief of the army staff anymore, so in that sense his leverage over the army to use it for further entrenchment is much more limited than before.
Well, if I may allow to comment on this, I think that happens, that's very good, but I don't see that as long as military has its own stakes in Pakistan's economy and lands, as it is being investigated by Dr. Aisha, and also I think it's important that there's very important, and Osama can, I think, comment on that, because now the National Security Council is part of our constitution. So whoever will come to power or will win more seats or form a government, they have to address the issue of National Security Council. And so far, the army has not come up with any position on National Security Council. Also, I think that there are many issues of army's control of our economy and lands and politics as well, because a large number of a significant number of politicians also now are retired generals and retired bureaucrats, and I think that brings a lot of problems to Pakistani politics and polity as well. So I think it's also important that how political parties are really going to take up this issue. As far as their manifestos are concerned, we see a very little mention of how political parties are going to address demilitarization of Pakistani politics. So I think these are the areas which needs a lot of discussion and resolutions and some consensus on that. But I think I have a lot of hope with the civil society movement, which has been going on for the last year.
And this is perhaps the longest movement of Pakistan's history. And it has a secular character. It is very peaceful. And it is widespread all over Pakistan. And in my view, I think if we look at the civil society movement, wherever we have courts, whether they are in Sawat or in Malakand or in tribal areas or in Balochistan, this movement is popular among civil society organizations, among journalists, and of course among bar councils. So I think whoever would win elections, they have to think that how they are going to address demands of the civil society movement, which and these demands are very much important in Pakistan's history. And it's very, very crucial that that political parties start thinking about that, because only one party or the boycotting parties are taking up this issue. But I think these are the few issues which are needed to be addressed. I personally feel that the urge to have an independent judiciary and free media and a strong civil society are the ingredients which are going to bring Pakistan transformation to democratic rule in, over here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think, as you know from our Perilous Course paper, that we started to address the military's role in Pakistan's future, and I think we will do one of these conversations in the next in the coming weeks on that issue, because it's really one that needs much further discussion. So thank you for bringing that forward. Could we have one last question, and then I'll just have some closing comments.
Thank you. This is Michael Suttles with the State Department. I had a question about complaint adjudication. This question is primarily for Dr. Darnulf. I wonder if you could go over the adjudication process. And I've seen that the ECP has posted over 1,500 complaints on the ECP website. I wondered if you could comment on how these complaints are being handled. I've heard conflicting reports about how they're being handled. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Right now, we are aware of about 2,500 complaints in total that have been lodged with the Election Commission, primarily from the PPP, but also from other parties. The ECP's ability to handle these complaints, and I would also say willingness to handle these complaints, are fairly limited. They tend to operate like a second Pakistan postal service. They will receive the complaints, they will lodge them, they will look at them, and for instance, if it is a complaint regarding violence, election violence, they will simply punt over the letter to the Minister of Interior, who's responsible for the police, and ask them to investigate and take appropriate action. After that, the Election Commission will close that file and say they've done everything that they're supposed to be doing. If we're looking a bit more on the adjudication and complaints after the election, that's when we're going to have election tribunals standing up. They need to stand up 45 days after the certification of the results. We're coming back to one issue here that was raised by one of my colleagues earlier, that some of these judges that will be presiding over these election tribunals have taken the oath under the new constitution, which could be very problematic. There's another issue that one needs to keep in mind when it comes to these election tribunals, and that's the fact that these judges, they still have to perform their full regular duty in the regular courts. So that's one of the reasons why these cases, these election petitions, can take years before they are being resolved. By law, they should be resolved within 120 days. Some are, a lot of them are not.
Thank you very much. I think this has been very much the session that we hope to have here. I would like to once again thank Mark and Vanessa Malaka from our team for making this happen, and for the technology to have worked so well. Thank you to our four distinguished guests in Pakistan. Thank you to the 40 attendees here. While I have my microphone open, maybe we can give our guests in Pakistan an ovation that they can hear through this microphone.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you all. You are helping us to gain a greater appreciation of the complexity of the Pakistan challenge. We have a thought. We are inviting our guests to a post-election analysis, which will be held on Wednesday morning here with three other guests, and I think Stefan will be back with us as well. We would look forward to being back in touch with those of you who in Pakistan who have helped us today. We will put Dr. Gilani's slides on our blog, which is PCRproject.com, if you want to pursue those. And there will be many of the bloggers that we are in touch with. We will provide links to those if you want to get more of the voice of the people. So thank you again. I've asked Vanessa to stand at the door. If you could just quickly tell her whether this format worked. We're just trying to figure out a way to get the voices of Pakistan here to Washington without having to bring people here on a regular basis. And if you could just let Vanessa know that, yeah, it worked, or maybe shorter, longer, give her some feedback. We'll use that as an informal survey. So we hope to see some of you next week on Wednesday the 20th, and thanks again to the South Asia Program for co-hosting this with us. Thank you to our guests in Pakistan. Good day.
Thank you.